Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, permanently archived in time at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do pages 18 to 49 of The Nation of Islam's The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, which is volume 3 of their series on the secret relationship between blacks and Jews. And we heard in our first session, this is our second session on this book, blacks and Jews had their relationship change as a result of Jewish propaganda. See, the Jews bought the blacks, brought them over to the Americas, and sold them for profit, and they also middlemaned all the products that black slavery produced, the tobacco, cotton, etc. So they benefited all ways. And they portrayed themselves as white because it was to their social advantage. But after this Leo Frank case, they began to portray themselves as co-sufferers of white racism. And Leo Frank is sort of the founding, America's original sin in relation to Jews, just the way they say slavery is their original sin on race. It's one of their propaganda lines. Leo Frank was lynched, but as the Nation of Islam pointed out last time, he appealed the case 13 times all the way up to the Supreme Court, and his sentence, his conviction and his sentence, which was to death, were upheld every single time. Leo Frank was guilty. And the Jews have been lying about that ever since the conviction came down, literally more than 100 years. Anyway, so we pick up with Leo Frank and Mary Fagan, Predator and Prey. Book divided into sections that are not numbered chapters, as is conventional. Anyway, a lot of pictures and graphics, which I'll describe. So we're going to do about 30 pages today, half of Predator and Prey. Picture of Leo Frank, and then underneath, quote from Albert Lasker, the father of advertising in the U.S., the Jew who arranged the defense and nationwide pro-Frank publicity campaign, Albert Lasker, a Jew, I believe, out of Chicago. And they say in parentheses, Leo Frank's financier. And he said, it was very hard for us to be fair to him. He impressed us as a sexual pervert. Did that make it into the Jews' musical parade that Leo, no, he's a hero in love with his wife. Text begins, page 19, Leo Max Frank was born in 1884 in Cuero, Texas, C-U-E-R-O, the son of a successful Texas merchant. At 3 months old, his folks moved to New York and raised young Leo in Brooklyn before he went on to Cornell University and eventually obtained a degree in mechanical engineering. When offered a chance to become the superintendent of his uncle's Atlanta pencil factory in 1908, Leo Frank went south to take the position. So, born in Texas, quickly moved to Brooklyn, raised in New York, typical Jew environment, goes to Cornell, majors in engineering, I believe, and a degree in mechanical engineering, and then he's, hey, your uncle runs a pencil factory, why don't you go manage that down in Atlanta? Okay. Though raised a New Yorker, Frank possessed a legitimate Southern royal heritage. His uncle was a pro-slavery Confederate veteran. It was an honorific distinction that facilitated his acceptance into the aristocracy of Atlanta's elite community of German Jews, the well-established leaders of the Southern business world. The city to think of there is Charleston, the counterpart to Rhode Island, the sort of the centers of slavery or slave shipping in the South and in the North, and that's where you found most of the Jews. And again, the Jewish immigration before 1880 was primarily German Jews and not too many. And then you had, after 1880, an influx of wilder, crazier, less civilized Jews, more shtetl-type Jews from Eastern Europe. That'd be Poland, Russia, and other parts of Southeastern Europe. So social differences. The German Jews are older, more established, more civilized than the upstarts. But anyway, Frank belonged to the older class of Jew. We see. So it helped his acceptance into the aristocracy of Atlanta's elite community of German Jews, the well-established leaders of the Southern business world. And again, they're middlemen. They're not the people who are farming or ranching or whatever. They are the people that the farmers sell to, sell their products to, the grain silo operators maybe, or the exchange people who buy your cotton by the bale, right? He soon married the daughter of a prominent Jewish family and moved into his in-law's residence. So her parents he's living with. So quickly did he earn the respect of the Jews of Georgia that they elected him president of the 500-member Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, the leading Jewish fraternal order in America. Footnote 6, that's from Oney, one of the main so-called academics who wrote about the Leo Frank affair. ATDSR 91011 AJ, May 2, 1913. 5. The National Pencil Company, then located at 37 South Forsyth Street in Atlanta, sat just about where the Sam Nunn Federal Center sits today. In 1913, the factory was part of a larger effort by American industrialists to diversify the Southern economy and expand its base beyond the one crop, cotton, king cotton, agricultural system that had for nearly three centuries made whites entirely dependent upon black slave labor. But that effort sought the modernization of infrastructure without budging from the region's political, economic, and cultural obligations to white racial supremacy. Blacks were still forced to remain at the lowest rung, even as the South pushed forward to grow beyond the plantation. Leo Frank fully embraced that vision and operated his factory by the exploitative methods and practices that emerged from the slavery system. Black employees at Frank's pencil factory were paid less, limited to the rudest jobs, and confined to segregated facilities, and they faced corporal punishment if thought to be underperforming. They could be whipped, I guess, or beaten. And that's, there were a couple more footnotes there. 8, just brief, 75, 77. 7 was the Federal Reconstruction period, 1865 to 1877, followed the Civil War, 1861 to 65. In 1890, Georgia had 4,285 factories, with its businesses worth $57 million, $1.4 billion today. In 1900, it had 7,504 factories. So in 10 years, it 50% more factories, 7,504 factories. And by 1910, the value of its businesses exceeded $200 million or $3.7 billion. So rapidly putting in factories and rapidly growing the economy over those 20 years, 1890 to 1910, $3.7 billion today. The masses of blacks, as in slavery, remain confined to agricultural labor in conditions of poverty and debt peonage. See Don Dodd and Winnell S. Dodd, Historical Statistics of the South, 1790 to 1970, University of Alabama Press, 1973, 18 to 21, quote, New Pencil Factory, The American Stationer, April 18, 1908, page 34. So blacks had the rudest jobs, were confined to segregated facilities, and they faced corporal punishment if thought to be underperforming. There were white restrooms in the upper floors and a Negro toilet in the basement. Child laborers worked long hours in primitive conditions for minuscule pay, while the enormous profits accrued to the pencil factory's owners. Anti-Defamation League attorney Dale Schwartz lamented that in Atlanta, quote, there were a lot of sweatshops that employed young teenagers at 10 cents an hour, wages, and a lot of them were owned by Jewish people. Frank, quote, viewed blacks as fundamentally inferior to himself and other Southern whites, unquote, according to Dr. Stephen A. Brown. He believed, quote, that Southern black society was divided into two distinct groups, good darkies, who could be trusted, and bad niggers, who could not, end quote. Worse, one of the company's major stockholders, the well-respected Oscar Pappenheimer, had in 1906, the same year in which whites sparked a major Atlanta riot, killing over 50 blacks, promoted Jim Crow legislation targeting all blacks in the South. That's Oscar Pappenheimer promoting Jim Crow for all the blacks in the South. And then a block quote, "I propose the registration of Negroes in the Southern states, 14 years of age and more. Each person so registered should possess a certificate in which should be entered description, date, and place of birth, and, at each registration, record of abode, employment, conduct, and reference. These certificates would before long be of great value to industrious, well-behaved people. Let others decide whether it be legal to pass laws bearing on this subject with reference to the colored race only." So, Oscar Pappenheimer, one of the pencil factory's stockholders, wanted essentially to register blacks. Pappenheimer's proposal was nearly identical to that which Adolf Hitler enforced against Jews 30 years later. And in the same Hitlerian tone, Pappenheimer said he wanted his law to target, quote, "trashy, thoughtless, and shiftless Negroes." Frank's 10 black workers could aspire to no higher than sweepers, haulers, elevator operators, furnace firemen, and night watchmen. Clearly, the National Pencil Company management saw itself as the industrial era's equivalent of a slave plantation. And there are a few more footnotes here. Howard Simmons, Jewish Times, Voices of the American Jewish Experience, Boston, Houghton Mifflin, 1988. Christian Boone, 100 years later, Leo Frank's Lynching in Georgia Still Resonates, from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, August 15, 2015, with the URL. Quote, "He operated a sweatshop. He employed teenage girls," Steve Oney said. Footnote 10. Stephen A. Brown, "When Middle-Class Ambition Met Southern Honor, A Cultural History of the Leo Frank Case." PhD dissertation, University of Illinois, Chicago, 1999, 199 to 203. And finally, footnote 11, Oscar Pappenheimer, A Practical Suggestion. Letter to the Editor, A.C., Atlanta Constitution, October 10th, 1906, 8, and Hertzberg Strangers, 193. Industrialization brought with it the addition of white women and children to the ranks of the exploited. Leo Frank's white employees were paid pittance wages of about 7 to 10 cents an hour for a 55-hour work week, amounting on average to a weekly wage of just $4.05, the equivalent today of under $6,000 annually. Frank's employees often worked in appalling filth, and as testimony would later reveal, the more than 100 young Gentile girls were often subjected to sexual harassment and even molestation. As one Jewish scholar admitted, quote, "Frank did hire child labor, did work at disgracefully long hours at pitifully low wages, and if he did not, as popular fancy imagined, exploit his girls sexually, he walked in on their privacy with utter contempt for their dignity. Like most factory managers of his time, he was, metaphorically at least, screwing little girls like Mary Fagan." Footnote 13. 12 and 13 is Leslie Fielder, Some Jewish Pop Art Heroes, Chapter 10 in the Collected Essays of Leslie Fielder, Volume 2, New York, Stein and Day, 1971, also quoted in Melnick, Black Jewish Relations, 57. About the factory conditions, see brief, 16, 28, 30, 32, 35, 36, 77, 80, 87, 105, 107, 119, 133, 148. And A.J., Atlanta Journal, August 22, 1913, 10. Footnote 12. On the wages and salaries of the factory's employees, there are several sources, some conflicting. According to the Pinkerton Report, filed by L.P. Whitfield, May 2, 1913, 1, Mary Fagan's salary was $4 per week. According to Mary Fagan Keene, Mary worked, quote, up to 55 hours a week for a little more than 7 cents an hour. God. Boone, 100 years later, CAG, May 1, 1913, 2, AC, August 5, 1913, 3, Nancy McLean, The Leo Frank Case Reconsidered, Gender and Sexual Politics in the Making of a Reactionary Populism, Journal of American History, 78, number 3, December 1991, 931, number 31. Quote, of Southern working women over the age of 16, 68% earned under $6 a week in 1907, 92.5% under $8. Younger workers earn considerably less. So you notice that NOI is taking great pains with these footnotes to document every last little thing they claim. Makes it a little slow going, but it's clear that it's all there, and there's nothing Jews can say to factually deny what was actually going on. Georgia alone, among all the then 48 U.S. states, allowed factory owners to employ 10-year-old children and to work them 11-hour days, 6 days a week. The problem had become such a disgrace that in 1906, the Southern Rabbinical Association argued that, quote, child labor is not far removed from slave labor. Footnote 14. McLean, the Leo Frank case reconsidered, 927. Dinnerstein, Leo Frank case, 7, 180-81, number 21. Frederick Copley Yarer, C-O-P-L-E, and then J-A-H-E-R. Leo Frank, A Definitive Reassessment. Review of And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank by Steve Oney, comma, Midstream 50, number 7, November-December 2004, 36. All these are separated by semicolons. April Elaine Blackburn, In the Midst of the World, Jewish and Catholic Responses to New South Industrialization, 1880-1914, PhD dissertation, Temple University, 2002, 121. See also Moral Cleanup Urged for City, : Eliminate White Slave Traffic, says Vice Commission, from AC, Atlanta Constitution. That was a report in a paper, October 8, 1912, 5, meaning page 5. The issue of females in the industrial workforce was also a growing concern for white Southerners. Footnote 16. AG, April 30th, 1913, Home Edition 1. AG, May 5th, 1913, Night Extra Edition 2. AG, April 28th, 1913, 4. AC, April 30th, 1913, 5. Quote, if children of such tender years were not forced to work, little Mary Fagan would probably never have been murdered, declared Dr. A.J. McKelway, president of the Southern Sociological Congress. Slavery's replacement was a sharecropping system that enveloped both the black ex-slave and a fast-expanding number of poor whites. As industrialization spread, many young girls were forced into the city factories where they worked under the unchecked control of white male managers. Their wages, meager as they were, amounted to a substantial part of Southern family income. By 1907, more than 70% of the South's female industrial workers, black and white, were under the age of 19, and they would soon make up an even larger portion of Atlanta's workforce. Footnote 18. McLean, the Leo Frank case reconsidered, 921-22. Leonard Dinnerstein, Atlanta in the Progressive Era, A Dreyfus Affair in Georgia, in the Age of Industrialism in America, : Essays in Social Structure and Cultural Values. Editor Frederick Copley Yarer, New York Free Press, 1968, 133, 142-43. Melnick, Black Jewish Relations, 68. Dinnerstein, Leo Frank Case, 10. Between 1870 and 1930, the number of women in the workforce increased threefold. Brown, quote, when middle-class ambition met Southern honor, 114. By 1920, quote, 42% of all Atlanta women aged 16 and over had joined the workforce. By 1920, 42% of all Atlanta women were in the workforce. See Jacqueline Dowd Hall, quote, O, Delight Smith's Progressive O period Delight Smith's Progressive Era, : Labor, Feminism, and Reform in the Urban South, in Visible Women, New Essays on American Activism, editors Nancy A. Hewitt and Suzanne Lebsack, Urbana, Illinois, University of Illinois Press, 1993, 172. When Georgia politician Tom Watson spoke of female employees as being in the, quote, possession, unquote, of their factory bosses, it struck a resentful chord in southern white males who watched helplessly as, quote, progress, unquote, lowered their women into a position no different in any discernible way from that traditionally reserved for blacks. It was commonly believed that it was impossible for a female factory worker to remain a virgin. One mill owner confided that, quote, to let a girl go into a cotton factory was to make a prostitute of her. And during slack seasons in the labor calendar, young women were even more vulnerable to sexual coercion. Footnote 19. Dinnerstein, Leo Frank Case, 10. Melnick, Black-Jewish Relations, 51, 64, 81. Mary's mother declared that she would never have permitted Mary to go out to work, quote, if it hadn't been that there were five children in the family. A.G., April 28, 1913, 3. And Mary, having reached the age of only 13 at the time of her death, had previously worked at a knitting mill in Marietta, Georgia. A.C., April 30, 1913, 2. Watson spoke in behalf of this new exploitable labor pool when he described them as, quote, chattel slaves of a sordid commercialism that has no milk of human kindness in its heart of stone. Footnote 20. Fagin Keane, The Murder, 160. Lindemann, The Jew Accused, 263, 240. McLean, The Leo Frank Case Reconsidered, 929, 935. Dinnerstein, Leo Frank Case, 98. Melnick, Black-Jewish Relations, 104, 32. Quote, the factory would be one kind of plantation, unquote. White Southern males had readily left their communities to fight for the Confederacy, leaving the white female in the care and protection of black male slaves, with nary a discussion or fear of black male aggression. The mood of the city and of the time is best reflected in a 1912 report by a commission established to examine the Georgia-wide commercial prostitution of white girls and women known as, quote, white slavery. Block quote. The end of the battle is not yet for those girls who struggle on alone and unprotected with their more pressing financial problems. The greatest menace before her is man. The advances of men without even a spark of bravery or honor who hunt as their unlawful prey this impoverished girl, this defenseless child of poverty, unprotected, unloved, and uncared for as she is plunged into the swirling, seething stream of humanity. The advances of men who are so low that they have lost even a sense of sportsmanship and who seek as their game a tired, lonely, and destitute girl. She suffers and goes down and is finally sacrificed to a life of shame, but what of him? He escapes. It is not just, and this type of man should be severely punished. Footnote 21. Moral cleanup urged for the city. Eliminate white slave traffic, says Vice Commission, AC, Atlanta Constitution, October 8, 1912, 5. Edward Bristow, The German-Jewish Fight Against White Slavery, Leo Beck Institute, Yearbook, 28, Issue 1, 1983-301, quote, in the three decades after 1880, Jews played a conspicuous role in white slavery, as the commercial prostitution of that era was dramatically called. The scope of Jewish white slavery was breathtaking. Edward J. Bristow, Prostitution and Prejudice, The Jewish Fight Against White Slavery, 1870-1939. See, they say they're fighting against it, but they're actually engaged in it and promoting it. New York, Oxford University Press, 1982. Robert Rockaway, Review of Prostitution and Prejudice, The Jewish Fight Against White Slavery, 1870-1939, by Edward J. Bristow in Studies in Contemporary Jewry, Volume 2, editor Peter Y. Medding, Bloomington, Indiana, Indiana University Press, 1986, 310. See also Nellie Lass, L-A-S, White Slavery, Jewish Women, A Comprehensive Historical Encyclopedia, March 1, 2009, Jewish Women's Archive, with the URL. Most Southerners wanted to believe that some semblance of chivalry and honor was maintained in the sprawling Atlanta factories, but the ugly fact is that the National Pencil Company was among those businesses included in the commission's grim appraisal. Turning on to page 25, new section, the murder, or subsection, the murder. Picture of the National Pencil Company. Quote, the horrible mutilation of the body of Mary Fagan proves that the child was in the hands of a beast unspeakable. Dot, dot, dot. Footnote 22, Dinnerstein, Atlanta in the Progressive Era, 139. The Jewish-owned National Pencil Company was closed for business on Saturday, April 26, 1913, but not for the traditional Jewish Sabbath. It was closed for Confederate Memorial Day in honor of the dead and aging soldiers who had fought with valor, but in vain, to maintain America's most profitable economic institution, black slavery. Frank arrived at the Forsyth Street factory at about 8:30 a.m. and attended to routine paperwork in his second-floor office. The factory payday was usually Saturday at 12 noon, but given the holiday, the payoff time had been moved up to Friday. Frank expected the few who had missed it to come in on Saturday. Footnote 23. At the coroner's inquest, Leo Frank testified that he had arrived at the factory at 8:25 a.m. on Saturday. Later at the trial, he changed the time to 8:20 a.m. Brief 22, 31, 52, 177, quote, Frank on witness stand, quote, A.G., May 5th, 1913, 1, 2. On payday, see brief, 16. A.C., August 19th, 1913, 2. Mary Fagan had asked her friend and co-worker, Helen Ferguson, to pick up the $1.20 due her on Friday, just as she had on two past occasions, but this time, in italics, Helen was told by Leo Frank, I can't let you have it. So Mary would have to come herself the next day to be paid. Key reason. No reason for the refusal was given. Footnote 24. Brief 42. Quote, girl asked for Mary Fagan's pay, but was refused by Frank. AC, Atlanta Constitution, August 3, 1913. 4. According to National Pencil Company clerk James Gant, allowing a worker to collect the pay of a fellow employee, quote, was frequently done, unquote. See, quote, Gant, once Fagan suspect, on stand Wednesday afternoon. AC, July 31st, 1913. 4. By Saturday noon, several factory employees had arrived, taken care of their business with Frank, and departed. Two carpenters renovating the fourth floor were still in the building. A black janitor named James, quote, Jim Conley was stationed on the first floor, and Frank was alone on the second floor in his office when Mary Fagan arrived shortly after noon. Footnote 25. Brief. 2, 3, 13, 21, 22, 26, 29, 30, 31, 32, 35, 52, 54, 69, 70, 71, 74, 75, 79, 83, 85, 285, 101, 102, 103 to 104, 106, and 107 to 108. Okay, so the Jew doesn't give her paycheck to her friend as he has before. What's his reason? Well, we'll find out. But anyway, it forces her to come in on Confederate Memorial Day on that Saturday to get her paycheck for a miserable $120. Earlier that week, Mary had been laid off from her job operating a machine that attached erasers to pencils. The sheet brass that formed the metal bands that hold the erasers to the pencils had run out, leaving Mary without employment until the metal could be restocked. Footnote 26. Brief. 1, 22, 7, 186. ONI, ATDSR, 5, 8 to 9. AC, May 1, 1913, 1. AC, May 6, 1913, 2. So she's laid off because they run out of the metal. Frank met with Mary in his office shortly after noon, 27, A.G. May 5th, 1913, 2, also A.J., July 31st, 1913, 5, and A.C., August 2nd, 1913, 2. Frank met with Mary in his office shortly after noon and gave her an envelope with her pay. She then asked him if the expected shipment of metal had yet arrived. Mary was, in effect, asking Frank whether she should expect to come back to work on Monday. Frank said to her, "I don't know." The events from this point forward have been in dispute for nearly a century. Prosecutors convinced a jury that Frank's ambiguous answer, "I don't know," was in reality a ploy designed to lure Mary down the hall and into the secluded back storage room, ostensibly to see whether the metal shipment had indeed arrived. Frank's attorneys would later dispute this, claiming that he had answered her with a firm no, but the detective who first testified of Frank's uncertain reply had been hired by Frank himself. Footnote 28, Brief 22-25. This testimony came from Detective Harry Scott, assistant superintendent of the local branch of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who had interviewed Frank on April 28th. The agency had been hired by Frank himself. See also A.C., August 19th, 1913, 2, A.J., July 31st, 1913, 1, A.J., May 6th, 1913, 11, A.C., May 6th, 1913, 2, A.C., April 29th, 1913, 1. In his testimony at the inquest, the only sworn testimony he ever gave in the murder, Frank, in answer to the coroner's query, had the metal of which Mary Fagan spoke come at that time, stated, quote, "I don't think it has come yet," unquote. C.A.G., May 5th, 1913, 2. So he's got a ruse to lure the girl into the back room where he can make his advances. Alone with the girl, prosecutors contended, Frank closed the door behind them and lustfully forced himself upon her. She resisted, and in the struggle, Frank struck Mary in the face, causing her to fall backward, her head striking the steel handle on one of the machines. The impact gouged the back of her head and knocked her unconscious. Frank, fearing the consequences if she were to regain consciousness and make the assault known, wrapped a cord around Mary's throat and strangled her to death. The cord was wound so tightly that it remained embedded in her neck when the undertaker later removed Mary's body from the factory. Footnote 29, Brief 7826444546 47. In A.G., April 28, 1913, 5, the cord is described as a, quote, "strong piece of twine," and, quote, "a big twine." It was then, prosecutors say, that a panicked Leo Frank summoned the factory's black janitor, James Conley, swore him to secrecy, and ordered him to help move the body to the basement. Conley and Frank carried Mary's body to the elevator, and upon reaching the basement, dragged her body across the dirt floor to a final resting place near a trash pile by the furnace. Both men then returned to Frank's second-floor office, where he gave Conley a pad of paper and ordered him to write, as Frank dictated. Conley wrote note after note, but the efforts of the barely literate janitor were unable to satisfy his agitated boss. A total of 4 notes were written, all to appear as if they were scrawled by the dying girl herself, fingering her assailant, a black man. Frank then ordered Conley to return that day, later, to burn the girl's remains in the basement furnace. Come back later and burn her remains in the furnace, promising him a cash reward and threatening to put the notes by the body. Conley left the factory never to return that day. Footnote 30, Brief 5758, CAC, August 6, 1913, page 2. Turning on to 28. At 1:10 p.m., shortly after Conley left, Frank left for lunch at his home so as not to diverge from his customary routine. Frank returned to the factory at approximately 3 o'clock p.m. and waited in vain for Conley, and, unable to incinerate the body himself, left 2 cryptic notes next to the dead girl. At 4 p.m., another black employee, night watchman Newt Lee, arrived at the factory to work his overnight shift. He had been employed at the factory for 3 weeks, but this was the first time he had encountered a locked front door. Lee used his key to pass through, but Frank rushed from his office to inform Lee that he did not need him until 6 o'clock p.m. Lee asked if he could stay in the factory to rest for the next couple of hours. Even though the factory was completely empty, Frank refused this request and sent Lee away. Lee returned promptly at 6, and Frank this time let him punch in and begin his duties as a night watchman. Moments later, a white former employee named James Gant arrived at the front door unexpectedly and asked to retrieve some shoes he said he had left at the factory. Frank had fired Gant 2 weeks before and appeared startled by Gant's presence. Frank refused his request, telling Gant that he had seen the custodian throw out a pair of shoes. Gant countered that he had left 2 pairs, whereupon Frank relented and allowed his former bookkeeper into the factory, but ordered Lee to escort him as Frank left for home. Gant found both pairs of shoes and left. Footnote 31, AC, April 30th, 1913, 1, brief, 2, 3, 5, 18, 20, 244. Quote, Negro watchman tells story of finding girl's body, ... end quote. AJ, April 30th, 1913, 1, 6. Newt Lee tells his story during morning session. AC, May 1st, 1913, 3. Newt Lee on stand at inquest tells his side of the Fagan case, unquote. AG, April 30th, 1913. Final edition, 1, 2. Complete summary of testimony of witnesses at inquest. AJ, April 30th, 1913, 6. Gant had been at the factory 3 or 4 times after he had been discharged. Brief, 33. Less than an hour later at 7 p.m., Frank called Lee at the factory and asked if everything was all right, something he had not done before. 32, footnote. 32. Frank said he had called to make sure Gant had left. Brief 201. But Lee said Frank did not ask about Gant. Brief 3. Also, brief 305, 6. So, this Jew forces this girl to come in. Then on the pretext of checking whether she has work, he makes his move on her. She resists. He punches her. She goes unconscious. He kills her. And then he panics and has the black guy janitor come up to help him dispose of the body and instructs him to write some notes. And then tells him to come back later and burn the girl's stuff. But he doesn't come back later. And then the night watchman, then he goes home for lunch from 1 to 3. Then he comes back. The night watchman comes at 4. He says, get out of here. Come back at 6. He comes back at 6. Then he goes home himself and calls at 7, which he never has done because he's wondering. The reason he calls, he's wondering if the body's been found yet because it's down in the basement. Frank would later claim that he had called the factory to make sure that James Gant had left, the guy who came looking for his shoes, a former fired bookkeeper. But Lee testified that Frank did not ask about Gant. 33. Brief 3. At 3 a.m. Sunday morning, Lee again made his hourly... Again, he's punching a time clock. He's punching in every hour or even every half hour to prove that he's going around the grounds and checking. At 3 a.m. Sunday morning, Lee again made his hourly rounds, and while in the basement, he noticed a strange heap in the distance that appeared to be a body. At first, he thought that some co-workers were playing a trick on him, but he soon realized he had found the dead body of a white girl. Immediately, Lee telephoned Leo Frank, but strangely, none of the 4 adults at Frank's home answered. Lee then called the police, who arrived at the factory within minutes. Footnote 34. Those unanswered phone calls are covered in the brief 11, 12, 40, 111, 112, 127, 129, 147, 202, 252. Also see brief 467, AC, July 30th, 1913, 2, AC, August 3rd, 1913, 2. So all this is covered repeatedly in the papers and the trial and the brief itself. All this is documented. So he finds the body 3 a.m. as Saturday turns into a Sunday, and he calls Frank, who's not there, so he calls the police, and they get there immediately. The investigating officers found that the body, clothing, and face of Mary Fagan were dirty from having been dragged across the filthy basement floor. They found two notes next to her body. Footnote 35. Brief 7, 8, 9, 43, 46, 47, 48. AC, August 2nd, 1913, 3. The police immediately arrested the Black Knight watchman, Newt Lee. Soon thereafter, as leads and information surfaced, they arrested the fired white employee who had come for his shoes, James Gant, G-A-N-T-T, a former streetcar conductor and friend of Mary's named Arthur Mullinax, and a 19-year-old black elevator operator at the factory named Gordon Bailey. Shortly after 7 o'clock Sunday morning, 7 a.m., Sunday morning, officers went to Leo Frank's house to question him. 2 days later, they arrested him for the murder of Mary Fagan. Footnote 36. Brief 21-137, AC, April 28, 1913, 1 and 2. AC, April 29, 1913, 1. AC, April 30, 1913, 1. AG, April 28, 1913, 1. AG, April 29, 1913, 1, 2, 3. AG, April 30, 1913, 1 and 2. AJ, April 28, 1913, 1 and 3. AJ, April 29, 1913, 1, 4, 5. So these are all the references to the local Atlanta papers covering this stuff a couple days after it happened. In late April 1913. A white man named Paul Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, was arrested on Monday, May 5th in Houston, Texas, on suspicion of Mary Fagan's murder. He was released the next day. CAC, May 7th, 1913, 1. AG, May 6th, 1913, night edition, 1 and 2. Turning on to page 30 is a full page graphic showing the layout in the interior of the National Pencil Factory, Atlanta, Georgia, Saturday, April 26, 1913, 12:03 p.m. This is the shows you all this took place on the second floor, at least the killing. Blood, hair found in the second floor, inner office, Frank's office, metal room. So she worked on the same floor as his office. His office is on the left, sort of front. Her metal room, where she put the metal on the pencils, is in the second floor, far back, and there's a lot of stuff in between. So she would have come in, walked up the stairs to the second floor, and then gone left and gone into his outer and then inner office. And then he would have taken her, said, "I don't know if the metal's in yet." They walked all the full length of the second floor down to the metal room where she would work to see, ostensibly, if the metal was there. And that's where he made moves on her and killed her. And then they dragged the body all the way down to the basement. Beneath the first floor. So, that's a graphic on page 30. Next subsection, the case against Leo Frank, page 31. The immediate arrest of the nearest black man was standard procedure in America and had sufficed up until the Fagan murder case as state-of-the-art policing. Crime's been committed, grab the nearest nigger. Just makes sense, good sense. Today they call that profiling and they'd scream about it. Indeed, night watchman Newt Lee was charged with a crime while standing in the basement after leading police to the body. By practiced tradition, it would be only a matter of hours before the requisite lynch mob would assemble and take care of its gory responsibilities. Even the Atlanta Georgian, one of the three Atlanta dailies that seized upon the case as a major breaking news, reported, quote, "The theory that the crime was the work of a Negro held full sway and was assiduously followed by detectives until Sunday afternoon." So it happened, the crime happens midday Saturday. It's discovered 3 a.m. Sunday morning. It's thought to be the work of a black until Sunday afternoon. Footnote 37, which says, John M. Gant accused of the crime. A.G., April 28, 1913, 2, the guy who came back for his shoes. A.C., April 29, 1913, 1, 2, old police reporter analyzes mystery. A.G., May 4, 1913, 2A, colon. It was perfectly clear that the public was willing to put the extraordinary act in the category known as, quote, Negro crimes. And the sentiment of the streets was that Lee was guilty or knew the guilty man. The Fagan case is not a, quote, white man's crime, or if it is a white man's crime, it is extraordinary and most unusual. Again, back then it wasn't illegal to use your mind to notice patterns and form accurate generalizations about the world that are denounced as stereotypes and made criminal today. Even Mary Fagan's stepfather believed Lee guilty. The night watchman who found the body, Newt Lee. Stepfather of dead girl outspoken against Lee. A.G., April 29, 1913, extra number 5, home edition 2. Stepfather thinks Negro is murderer. A.J., April 29, 1913, 5. Negro watchman is accused by slang girl's stepfather. A.G., April 29, 1913, extra edition 1. So, without knowing the facts, they're accusing him based on general presumptions, but the key is that they corrected those when better evidence came in, or when actual evidence came in. They didn't have any evidence other than this guy discovered the body. So, adding to their concern was the noticeably nervous demeanor of factory superintendent Leo Frank when they go to talk to him on Sunday morning, the last person to see Mary Fagan alive. When detectives appeared at his door early Sunday morning to inform him of the crime, he was standoffish and argumentative, insisting that he have a cup of coffee before he would accompany the police to the crime scene. He had not answered the early morning phone calls from his night watchman or the two phone calls from police, and he sent his bathrobed wife to answer the door, even though he was fully clothed. The police at the scene described Frank as extremely nervous, direct quote, quote, quivering, quote, overwrought, and quote, pale. Extremely nervous, quivering, overwrought, pale, a guilty little homunculus Jew. According to one officer at the scene, Frank did not even ask what had occurred. Quote, I didn't tell him what had happened, and he didn't ask me. Footnote 39. Brief, 10, 12, 14, 17, 93, 202, 205. For county police officer and future bailiff W.W., quote, Boots Rogers' testimony at the coroner's inquest, C.A.J., May 8, 1913, 8. As the Jewish writer Leslie Fiedler wrote, true enough, Frank behaved oddly in his first encounters with the police, appeared guilty of something, though God knows what, evasive, shifty, and by all accounts he seems to have been a singularly unappealing young man. This Jew is acting like he was acting that for some reason other than his obvious guilt. A race of liars they are. Fiedler, Some Jewish Pop Art Heroes, 135. Frank was brought to the pencil factory where he appeared so nervous that he could not operate the elevator to the basement. The factory personnel manager, N.V. Darley, had to take the controls to accomplish that simple task. A policeman detailed to watch the factory from the street reported that Frank came to the window many times, nervously rubbing his hands. Footnote 40. Brief 42-43. This behavior contrasted noticeably with that of the night watchman, Newt Lee, who, with 62 lynchings of American black men, women, and children in the previous year, had every reason to be terrified. Lee showed no sign of anxiety as he brought the authorities to the body and recounted every detail of his day. 41. Brief 10, 32, 33. According to one of the police officers, quote, Lee was composed at the factory. He never tried to get away. Also, A.J., May 8th, 1913, last edition 1. Other actions and behaviors police observed in the first moments of the investigation fed their suspicions about Leo Frank. 42. Lindemann, the Jew accused, 245, quote, still further evidence, much more palpable and persuasive, pointed in Frank's direction. Bullets. other actions that fed their suspicions. Four bullets. One, first bullet. When Frank was taken to the morgue to identify the body, the undertaker pulled back the curtain concealing the dead girl, but Frank refused to look at her. 43 footnote. There is brief 12. There is controversy on this point. See IBID 1415, 1719. Second bullet. So they take him to the coroner. He won't look at her, or at least it's argued. Newtley reported that the gaslight in the basement had been turned down to its lowest level, but that he had left it burning bright, direct quote, the night before. It was suspected that the murderer did this to conceal the victim from the night watchman so that he could later return to dispose of the body. Footnote 44. Brief 357. See also, Negro watchman tells the story of finding girl's body and questions fail to shake him. A.J., April 30th, 1930, 13, 6. Quote, did murderers plan cremation? Atlanta Constitution, April 30th, 1913, 14. Third bullet, even though he was not yet a suspect and had not been charged with any crime, Frank hired Georgia's most celebrated lawyer, Luther Rosser, and the nationally renowned Pinkerton Detective Agency. The police saw those hirings as suspicious behavior for an innocent man. Footnote 45, which reads, quote, Pinkertons hired to assist police. Atlanta Constitution, April 29th, 1913, 1. So this is front page material in the local papers, of course. Quote, last night the Pinkerton Detective Department was engaged by Leo M. Frank to aid the local officers. Also, AC, May 12, 1913, 1. Factory head taken into custody. Lawyer Bard later admitted to his client. To client. AG, April 29, 1913, extra number 5, home edition 2. Brief, 17, 18, 29, 41. AJ, April 28, 1913, last edition 1. Harry Scott said Leo Frank called him up Sunday afternoon. Remember, he wasn't arrested just yet, so he's already calling to arrange for these people to defend him. CAG, May 8, 1913, 2. Fourth bullet point. From the first confrontation with police, Frank maintained that he did not know Mary Fagan, but when an opportunity arose to shift suspicion onto the former employee who had come to recover his shoes, James N. Gant, Frank told police that Gant had shown interest in courting the girl. Frank's sudden knowledge of the girl and an alleged amorous relationship alarmed investigators. So this little Weasley little Jew is lying, and he's not lying very credibly or very effectively. The cops can basically see right through him. And that was footnote 46 after that fourth final bullet point. AC, April 29, 1913, 1. Quote, it was largely upon Frank's testimony that the search for Gant continued. In fact, Gant knew Mary Fagan's family, but had no romantic interest in her, as Frank implied. CAC, April 29th, 1913, 3. Atlanta Journal, April 29th, 1913, 4. AG, April 29th, 1913, 3. The physical evidence collected at the factory only fueled suspicion of the B'nai B'rith leader. It appeared that a violent confrontation had occurred in the rear section of the second floor, the same floor where Leo Frank's office was located. A splattering of blood on the floor was found, along with a few strands of hair on a machine handle, identified as belonging to the victim. Only Leo Frank and Mary Fagan were known to have been on this floor after the noon hour. Footnote 47. Brief 9-11, 9-11, 19, 22, 23, 26-28. 30, 33, 43, 45 to 46, 77, 92 to 93, 96 to 97, 105 to 107, 110, 118 to 121, 138, 211, 214. Mary's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, swore that, quote, as far as he could tell, the hair was Mary's. Also AC, April 29, 1913, 1. AJ, April 28, 1913, 3. A.J., February 21st, 1914. A.J., May 1st, 1914. So the evidence on the second floor, blood and hair, belonged to Mary Fagan, and only Leo Frank and Mary Fagan were known to have been on this floor after the noon hour. A witness said that on the morning of the murder, Frank, quote, had a club which he used to play with in his hand, and he was carrying it around. And when Frank was arrested, police confiscated a pocket knife, quote, he had been in the habit of carrying, of the kind that might have been used to cut the cord found tightly wound around Mary's neck, and the part of her undergarment found under her head to catch the blood. Footnote 48. A.J., August 12, 1913, 5. A.J., May 6, 1913. This, quote, heavy cord was described in A.G., April 28, 1913, 5, as a, quote, strong piece of twine and, quote, a big twine. Frank had emphatically claimed that he had never left his office during the probable time of the murder, but a factory employee named Montine Stover came forward to say that she had also come up for her pay that day and waited for Frank at his empty office for 5 full minutes before leaving empty-handed. Footnote 49. Brief 22-24-25-26, A.G., May 10, 1913, Pinkerton, filed by Harry Scott, May 3, 1913, 3, Frank's testimony at the inquest, A.G., May 5, 1913, 2, A.G., May 6, 1913, 2, A.C., May 6, 1913, 2, A.J., May 6, 1913, 11, A.J., May 7, 1913, 1, and 18. See also trial testimonies of Pinkerton detective Harry Scott and National Pencil Company employee Montine Stover in Atlanta Journal, July 31, 1913, 1, 5, 6, and Frank's unsigned statement made to police in the presence of his attorney Luther Rosser on April 28, 1913, in brief, 243. Oney, ATDSR, 4950, 655, note to page 49. So Frank is claiming, well, yeah, I was on the second floor during this time, but I was in my office, and I didn't move out of there. But then Montine Stover, another, well, I came up, and I was in there 5 minutes, and he wasn't there, and then finally I left because I couldn't get my check because he wasn't there. George Epps, EPPS, a 14-year-old friend of the murdered girl, said that Mary told him that she was afraid of Frank because he had, quote, winked at, quote, flirted with, and made advances toward her. Footnote 50. Quote, Frank tried to flirt with murdered girl, says her boy chum. A.C., May 1st, 1913. 1, 2. A.G., May 1st, 1913. 2. And in a bombshell statement, the black woman who was the cook at Frank's home, again, he's living with his in-laws, Manola McKnight, the black cook, Manola, M-I-N-O-L-A, McKnight, M-C-K-N-I-G-H-T, said that she had overheard Frank's wife and her mother discussing Frank's confession to the crime on the night of the murder. 51. Brief 224 to 229, 246, 47. Cook says she signed affidavit in order to get out of jail. A.C., August 13, 1913, 3. So the black cook, where Leo Frank lives for his in-laws and himself, says that Frank's wife and mother were discussing his confession. Frank's wife made a brief initial visit to the jail that held her husband, but did not actually see or talk to him, and she did not return again for at least 2 weeks. For many, Mrs. Frank's absence lent credence to the cook's original statement and led to the assumption that Frank's own wife believed him to be guilty. Footnote 52, and you think that's reflected in the musical parade that exculpates Frank and makes the South and whites the evil party? Answer is no. Footnote 52, A.G., May 12, 1913, 1, quote, Mrs. Frank paid her first visit to her husband since his arrest nearly 2 weeks ago. Also, brief 219-247. Mrs. Frank writes about Fagan case. A.C., June 8, 1913, A3. A.C., August 28, 1913, 5. And A.C., February 19, 1914, 1. The layers of evidence seem to lead consistently in one direction, away from the traditional suspect, the, quote, Negro Night Watchman, unquote, and toward Leo Frank. and yet more was to come. Though much of it could be classified as circumstantial, by April 29th, 3 days after the murder of Mary Fagan, enough of the evidence had been found to meet the standard of probable cause and justified Frank's arrest. 53. Reads, the newspapers continued to protect Frank's prestige and seemed unable to say he was arrested. He was, quote, held, quote, questioned, quote, detained for, quote, his own protection. So they're playing with language games in the media back then, even 100 years ago. They're not using the appropriate verb, arrested. All other suspects were arrested. In fact, one paper explicitly pointed out that Frank, quote, is not under arrest. And they use an exclamation point in the footnote, because he obviously was arrested. CAG, April 29th, 1913, extra number 5, home edition 2, 1, quote, Frank will be held on the technical charge of suspicion. He will not be placed in a cell, but he will be under guard. Close quote. Next subsection, on page 35, the framing of a black man, Newt Lee. There was much talk of lynching, but it was aimless talk, directed against no one in particular. The general opinion seemed to be that a Negro must be guilty, and the police did all they could to find a darkie on whom they could fix the crime. Herbert Asbury, that's footnote 54, which reads, Herbert Asbury, Hearst comes to Atlanta. American Mercury, Mencken's paper, Mencken's magazine, January 1926, 90. Hearst, the big publisher out of California, of course. Within 24 hours of the Saturday murder, Leo Frank's crisis management team was quickly taking form. On Sunday afternoon, Frank met with several members of the B'nai B'rith, the Jewish organization for which he served as president, including several of its lawyers. Footnote 55, brief 208-9-116. They included Mr. and Mrs. Alex Marcus, Arthur Haas, Ed Montag, Marcus Loeb, Henry Bauer, Mr. and Mrs. Charlie Ersenbach, Mr. and Mrs. Sig Selig, Ike Haas, Edgar Haas, Montefiore Selig, Mr. and Mrs. Paul Lippmann, Mr. and Mrs. Ike Strauss, and Mr. and Mrs. Carl Wolfsheimer. Just like out of F. Scott Fitzgerald, all those are German Jew names. In fact, a B'nai B'rith officers meeting had been scheduled for Sunday morning. The Montag brothers, owners of the National Pencil Company, hired Luther Z. Rosser, who was not only the most prominent attorney in Georgia, but also the new law partner of the state's governor-elect, John M. Slayton. And that's where they applied the pressure to get Leo Frank not to be executed, but commuted to like life in prison the day before he left office. The significance of which would play out many months later as the case moved to its ultimate climax. So they hired the state governor-elect John M. Slayton's partner, Luther Rosser. Later that day, Frank himself hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency, a Goy Detective Agency, footnote 56, brief 22-93-130-11, AC, April 30th, 1913, 2. Quote, Pinkerton Detective tells of call from factory head, AG, May 8th, 1913, 2. So later that day, Frank himself hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency, stating publicly that he wanted the Pinkertons to assist the city detectives in ferreting out the perpetrator of the crime. You can only recall O.J., and he's going to get to the bottom of this. The professional and well-heeled pillars of Atlanta's Jewish elite came to Frank's defense, it soon became apparent, with a scorched earth, all-or-nothing approach to his exoneration. Certainly, Frank had to be cleared of the heinous crime, but the explicit targeting of other individuals, and in italics, black individuals, to shoulder the blame became a clear objective of Frank's Jewish defenders. In his behavior and comportment, the factory's night watchman appeared to be exactly the kind of black man the white South was proud of. In his mid-50s, he had been born into slavery and had always been known to perform diligently those menial tasks fitted for the sons of Ham. Those are blacks in the Bible. Newt Lee was loyal and devoted to his responsibilities at the factory, but 3 days after the murder of the terrified black man sat handcuffed to a chair at Atlanta police headquarters, where he emphatically swore in a Bible that he had merely found the evidence of someone else's crime. 57, AC, April 28, 1913, 2, AC, April 30, 1913, 2, AJ, April 30, 1913, 7, according to Leo Frank, quote, Lee has been unusually faithful about his duties at the factory. So this is a black man, we could legitimately call him, of pretty good character, apparently. And despite headlines salivating for his lynching, 58, police found that Lee's story was unwavering, logical, and corresponded with the evidence they had collected so far, 59. So 58 and 59. 58, Lee's guilt proved. AG, April 29th, 1913, 1. Also, mayor confers with chief, says extras are misleading. AC, April 30th, 1913, businessmen protest sensational extras. AJ, April 30th, 1913, 1. Oney, 65, quoting AJ, July 31st, 1913, quote, an officer of the court said, quote, Frank was trying to point suspicion at Newt Lee, unquote. Explaining his motive and asking a question of Officer John Black, Solicitor Hugh Dorsey said, quote, I want to show that Frank was trying to point suspicion at Newt Lee, unquote. So the Jew tried to blame the black, and then years later Jews write a parade, a musical called Parade, that paints Hugh Dorsey as the bad guy. So Jews will do anything to exonerate their own. They don't care if he's guilty, they just want to get him off. They want to make the other people are the bad guys. The Jews are always the innocent victims. That's always how they play it. The facts matter not one bit. Not one atom. Not one iota. All Jews care about is this is a fellow Jew. We got to protect him. It doesn't matter if he's guilty or innocent. Jews are always innocent. They are always persecuted. They are always victims. That's always how we play it every single time. The others are always guilty. They are always persecuting us. Even if we rape and murder their daughters, they are the bad guys. We are gods, they are animals, there's an end to it. That's their attitude. It will not change. It is biological, and it is cultural. So, Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, said, I wanted to show that Frank was trying to point suspicion at Newt Lee. AJ, July 31st, 1913, 4. See also, quote, looks like Frank is trying to put the crime on me, says Lee. AG, April 30th, 1913, after afternoon extra edition 1. In brief, 19, John Black, quote, Mr. Frank had told me that he didn't think Newt Lee had told all he knew about the murder, unquote. And 59, AG, May 1st, 1913, AG, May 19th, 1913, extra edition 2. But Frank's people were lobbying hard to keep the police focused on the man Frank himself trusted to oversee and protect a building filled with advanced industrial machinery and a workforce of young white girls. He now publicly insisted that Lee either was the killer or had direct knowledge of the crime, and sensing the mood of Atlanta's white men, Frank added fuel to the public rage against Lee. Block quote. Under the present conditions of morals in Atlanta, these low characters undoubtedly have grown worse. That our janitor, Lee, was bribed to allow them, criminals, in the building, while a suspicion to me, is not an unbelievable suggestion. Such fellows as these might be expected to stoop to such things. That is a Jew Jewing Jewily, if I've ever seen it. Footnote 60 reads, New Dancers Pictures, AG, April 29th, 1913, extra number 6, night edition 4, night extra edition 4, quote, suggestive pictures on walls, AG, April 29th, 1913, extra edition 3, brief, 19, 234. It may be subliminally significant that Frank misidentified Lee as the janitor. He was the watchman. Conley was the janitor. The janitor, as we shall see, was indeed, quote, bribed many times by Frank himself to allow, quote, allow them criminals in the building. The Jew is blaming others for what he did himself. He's accusing others of doing things he himself has done repeatedly. Yet police remained unconvinced of Lee's guilt. They had found too many clues that seemed outside Lee's abilities and range, so they asked Frank to help them tighten the screws on his night watchman. Just 50 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, white employers of the South were seen as having slave master-like powers over their black employees. So when the police told Frank, who was then under arrest and in custody, in italics, that they thought he could get more out of the nigger, quote, could get more out of the nigger is a direct quote, than they could, so they're going to put Frank and Lee in the same room and try to get the, okay, if you're not, well, they know what they think, and they pretty much are aware of the truth, but they want to, this is a little thing they're going to do to try to get more. So when the police told Frank, who was then under arrest and in custody, that they thought he, quote, could get more out of the nigger, unquote, than they could, quote, Frank readily consented and on April 29th met with Newt Lee one-on-one, footnote 61, brief 4-7-24-216-17-305, quote, Leo M. Frank holds conference with Lee, AC April 30th, 1913. Lee's previous employer, T.Y. Brent, was brought in to assist in the interrogation. CAC April 29th, 1913, 2. Golden, a little girl, is dead, writes Frank could hear the police beating Lee, but Lee does not say this ever happened. See brief 7. Frank later claimed the police, quote, did everything but beat Newt Lee. Brief 217. Lee later told of the event in his sworn testimony, his meeting with Frank. This is a long block quote from Newt Lee, the black who Leo Frank's trying to blame. They went and got Mr. Frank and brought him in, and he sat down next to the door. He dropped his head and looked down. We were all alone. I said, Mr. Frank, it's mighty hard for me to be handcuffed here for something I don't know anything about. He said, what's the difference? They got me locked up and a man guarding me. I said, Mr. Frank, do you believe I committed that crime? And he said, no, Newt, I know you didn't, but I believe you know something about it. I said, Mr. Frank, I don't know a thing about it, no more than finding the body. He said, we are not talking about that now. We will let that go. If you keep up, we will both go to hell. Then the officers both came in. Footnote 62, brief 4, AJ May 9th, 1913, 6. Responding to Newt Lee's reference to the possibility of the murder having taken place on the second floor, Leo Frank said, let's don't talk about that. Let that go. After emerging from the strange session, Frank claimed, quote, that he had made every possible effort to get the truth and that Lee, quote, still sticks to his original story. Odd as it may seem for an innocent man, Frank had asked no actual questions of Lee. He had simply bided time and appeared to care little for the chance to gain vital information from an actual suspect who might add more pieces to the puzzle. And, of course, there's only one reason he'd do that. He knows who's guilty. In fact, the only question asked during the, quote, interrogation, unquote, was the one Lee asked of Frank. Do you believe that I committed that crime? 63, AC May 9th, 1913, 2. It was a mystery what Frank meant by, quote, we are not talking about that now, unquote, or, quote, if you keep that up, dot, 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 end quote. Frank recounts this episode under oath at the coroner's inquest, CAJ May 6, 1913, 11. But then Lee's testimony at the coroner's inquest cleared, quote, that, unquote, up, quote, I told him, Mr. Frank, that the killing must have been done in the daytime as all that night I had to pass once every 30 minutes by the machine where they said the little girl was killed. He wouldn't let me talk about it, unquote. CAC, May 9th, 1913, 2, column 3. The same issue, page 6, reported that Detective Harry Scotts testified that Lee, quote, said he had started to describe to Mr. Frank how he had found the body and that Mr. Frank said, let's don't talk about that anymore. Detective Harry Scott caught a portion of the session and provided an unusual description. Block quote. Mr. Frank was extremely nervous at that time. He was very squirmy in his chair, crossing one leg after the other, and didn't know where to put his hands. He was moving them up and down his face, and he hung his head a great deal of the time while the Negro was talking to him. He breathed very heavily and took deep swallows and sighed and hesitated somewhat. 64, brief, 24. And while Frank remained in custody, his team of hired agents appeared to have been operating in the shadows to establish a criminal profile for Newt Lee. The evidence of their extra-legal actions began to trouble Atlanta Chief of Detectives Newport A. Lanford, who suspected that there was an organized operation to throw detectives off the trail, and he brought his concerns to the newspapermen following the case. Under the Atlanta Constitution May 4th headline, Imposters Busy in Sleuth Roles in Fagan Case, it was revealed that two unknown men were posing as Pinkerton detectives and interviewing key witnesses. The article opened with a question. What interests are promoting the planting of evidence in the Mary Fagan mystery? Locke quote, "Not only are we being opposed, but evidence is being planted. We have discovered numerous signs of plants in the past few days and are not surprised at any, quote, frame-up." One of the bogus detectives had approached Mary's parents for an hour and for an hour questioned them on their daughter's, quote, character and habits. Another approached the boy who had last seen Mary on the trolley moments before her murder. Harry Scott, the lead Pinkerton detective in the southern region, was assigned to the case, but claimed to have no idea who these imposters were or on whose behalf they were operating. Scott had publicly taken a strong stand to do exactly what Fagan had asked of him, what Frank had asked of him, to find the murderer of Mary Fagan. By law, private detectives were required to share evidence and work closely with police, but that was not why industrialists hired the Pinkertons, who specialized in violent union busting and strike breaking, not crime solving. In this respect, Scott may have been intolerably honest to the Frank crew, who very likely engaged a second faction of Pinkerton agents to pursue a darker agenda. It was apparent to many on the Frank team that Harry Scott had become convinced of Frank's guilt and would be of limited use going forward. 65. See, quote, "Pinkerton chief is scored by Lanford." But that is the head of the cops. AG, July 28, 1913, 1. AC, July 27, 1913, 4. Chief Lanford, quote, "denounced H.B. Pierce, general superintendent of the Atlanta Pinkerton forces, for alleged questionable procedure in the Fagan investigation," unquote. Lanford added, quote, "during Detective Scott's absence from the city recently," unquote, "planted evidence," quote, "was found," unquote, "in the pencil factory, and their discovery was kept a secret while they rested in the hands of the defense," unquote. So all kinds of chicanery is going on as they try to pervert the course of justice into Jew-friendly channels. Whoever they were, it didn't take much investigative expertise to know that no black man had the kind of money, influence, and resources to enlist a stealthy stream of white agents with the ability to interrogate witnesses, plant evidence, and then disappear into the shadows. 66. The Atlanta Constitution, parentheses, the case of Mary Fagan, May 4, 1913, asked who planted the evidence and questioned whether, quote, "there was someone at large who was very, very busy while Newt Lee, Leo Frank, Arthur Mullinax, and J.M. Gant languished in jail." Again, the mystery. Who of the named detainees who had been planting evidence and why? Unquote. Missing from the list was Gordon Bailey. Clearly, only one of the named detainees, Leo Frank, had both the means and the motive for that tactic. See also, quote, "stains of blood on shirt fresh," says Dr. Smith, unquote, AC May 8, 1913. Next subsection, Frank's time slip-up. Those falsely generated clues, quote, "framing up the case," all pointed directly to Newt Lee as the murderer, and the first of those, quote, unquote, clues came by way of Leo Frank himself. Lee's duty at the factory was to check all four floors every half hour and then punch his time slip after completing each round. When police questioned Frank at the factory shortly after the body was discovered, he affirmed that Lee's time slip was correct. Verifying that Lee had dutifully performed his scheduled rounds up until the moment he discovered Mary's body. Footnote 67. Lee says Frank acted oddly. AG, July 28, 1913, 1-2. Also, quote, clock misses, add mystery. AG, April 30th, 1913, 3. But police inexplicably did not take the slip as evidence, leaving it with Frank, 68. So he says, yeah, he did the card right, and the police say, okay, and they leave the card there, and then he falsifies it, is what happened. 68, brief 4, 13, 14, 33, 205, AJ, April 30th, 1913, 1, 6. Frank claimed he had handed the time slip to a policeman, but when asked by the coroner what officers, he answered, I don't remember. Superintendent Frank is once more put on witness stand. AJ, May 9th, 1913, 6, also AG, May 9th, 1913, 2, and AC, May 9th, 1913, 2. The next day, Frank and the company of his lawyers reversed himself and said that he was mistaken and that the time slip, quote, contained errors in the form of, quote, three skips, unquote. And, quite remarkably, Frank's new reading of the time slip showed a block of time unaccounted for. Enough time for Lee to have gone home, concealed the evidence of his crime, and returned to work. Footnote 69. Brief 3, 4, 13, 14, 17, 19, 24, 33, 35, 235, 37, 39, 201, 204, 5, 209, 10, 234, 253, 54. See also Watchman Newt Lee on stand tells his own story. AG, April 30th, 1913, 2. AC, April 30th, 1913, 1. AC, May 1st, 1913, 3. AG, May 11th, 1913, 1 and 2A. Frank explained away his, quote, mistake by claiming that he and his manager, N.V. Darley, had at first only casually reviewed the time slip. Police found it difficult to believe that the meticulous superintendent would have missed a single discrepancy, much less three, quote, unquote, skips. It was Frank who calculated the pay and prepared the payroll weekly for many years for over 100 employees using these very time slips. That both he, italics, and his personnel manager were mistaken on the most important time slip they had ever analyzed strained the credulity of investigators. But it was this miraculous piece of evidence that made Newt Lee the prime suspect, and it was the raw meat the voracious Atlanta press needed to scream in a Tuesday afternoon headline, repeated Wednesday, Lee's guilt proved, footnote 71, and to further predict his lynching. 71. Now, are 70 and 71 related to this time slip? 70. A police officer also viewed the time slip and confirmed the punches had been made correctly by Newt Lee. Quote, I looked at the slip that Mr. Frank took out, Defendant's Exhibit 1. The first punch was 601. The second one was 632 or 633. He took the slip back in his office. I glanced all the way down. There was a punch for every number. Close quote. Brief 1314. 71. Quote, Lee's guilt proved detectives assert. Suspicion lifts from Frank. May be freed. Quote, AG April 29th, 1913. AG April 30th, 1913. Extra number 8, edition 1. Or edition. Extra number 8, edition 1. So the paper... It was this miraculous piece of evidence that made Newt Lee the prime suspect, and it was raw meat the voracious Atlanta press needed to scream in a Tuesday afternoon edition, repeated Wednesday, Lee's guilt proved, and to further predict his lynching. The Constitution was, in the meantime, editorializing that the murder was, quote, the most revolting crime in the history of Atlanta, that has no local parallel in sheer horror and barbarity, committed by some human beast with more than jungle cruelty and less than jungle mercy, with elements of horror and degeneracy that defy the written word. Footnote 72. $1,000 reward, AC, April 29th, 1913, 4. This language was strongly moderated over time once it became clear that the murderer might very well be the white Jewish president of the local B'nai B'rith. So when they think it's a black, they're going all out. But when they think it's a Jew, they're soft-pedaling it. Frank's corrected, quote-unquote, time slip was enough for the Atlanta Georgian to declare the case closed. Quote, additional clues furnished by the head of the Negro pencil factory were responsible for the closing net around the Negro watchman, clues spelled C-L-E-W-S. With the solution to the mystery at hand came the further information that what suspicion had rested on Frank was being rapidly swept away by the damaging evidence against the black man. Footnote 73, emphasis hours. And that would be, well, they emphasize the furnished by the head of the pencil. So they're giving him every opportunity to frame this guy, this black guy, and the papers are backing it up. Kind of the opposite of today, where they won't accept any evidence against blacks. Emphasis hours, AG, April 29th, 1913, extra number 8 edition, 2 and 1. And there are various little inset shots of the various people, like Darley or Chief James Beavers, or there's a graphic of the paper with Lee's guilt proved, the Atlanta Georgian, top front center. Reports that a, quote, mob of white men was being formed to lynch Lee caused Chief of Police James L. Beavers to activate 50 mounted police at the jail to protect him. The Atlanta Constitution reported just how close Lee was to a violent death. When Lee was brought to the crime scene in the police car, quote, threatening remarks came from the crowd that thronged around the machine, automobile. He ought to be lynched, said a heavyset man who edged closer. Yes, said another, and I'd help do it. 74. AC, April 29th, 1913, 2. At Mary Fagan's funeral, this was reported, quote, the nigger knows all about it, growled a sunburnt farmer, a wry, humorless smile disfiguring his face. And I could make him talk. Oh, yes, if we had that scoundrel in Marietta, we'd know how to get him to talk. We'd make him be polite. He'd talk just as pretty as you please for us. Either that or something else. While many Atlanta whites were deciding whether Lee would be destroyed by rope, bullet, or fire, others were not so quick to accept the time slip, quote, evidence, at face value. The Atlanta Constitution slowed Georgia's roll. Reporting, some theorists believe evidence was planted. They say that the watchman's clock evidence is flimsy and openly crude, and that's footnote 75. AC, April 30th, 1913, 1. Imposters busy in sleuth roles in Fagan case. AC, May 4th, 1913, 1. Clock misses add mystery to Fagan case. AG, April 30th, 1913, 3. There was more that disturbed the Constitution reporters. On Monday, April 28th, police investigators entered Newtley's residence and found a, quote, fancy, unquote, linen shirt, apparently covered with blood, at the bottom of a clothes hamper. The shirt was indeed his, but police quickly noticed it had not been worn, the blood stain was on the inside, and it appeared to have been wiped in blood as one would use a rag to wipe a table. 76. Brief. 1946, 2-10-11, AC, April 30th, 1913, 1. Stains of blood on a shirt fresh, says Dr. Smith. AC, May 8th, 1913, 1, 2. So they're going all out to frame this guy, but yet, even though they're going all out, they're being pretty careless with how they try to frame him. I mean, in terms of not they're like, look, someone obviously just wiped that shirt through some blood. I mean, that's not very good effort. Strangely, just moments before the search, Leo Frank's attorney and fellow B'nai B'rith member Herbert Haas has suggested to detectives that they examine Frank's soiled clothes bin for potential evidence, ostensibly to clear his client. Investigators saw this miraculously timed suggestion as Haas's attempt to bait detectives to examine the laundry hampers of both suspects. It's funny how it's just like with the Holocaust. They don't even make their lies plausible. It's easy to see what they're up to. And though Frank's lawyers had directed investigators to search Newtley's clothes bin, Frank himself had made a suspicious change of clothes on the day of the murder. He had worn a brown suit on that Saturday, a blue suit on Sunday, and then the brown suit again on Monday. 77. Frank admits to changing clothes under oath at the coroner's inquest in AJ May 6, 1913, 11, also AG July 30, 1913, 2, and AJ August 13, 1913, 5, for reference to Leo Frank's change of clothes. In those times before the widespread use of washing machines and dry cleaners, men wore the same work suit every day of the Monday to Saturday work week and another suit on Sunday, dedicated for church going. On the day of the murder, Frank went home for lunch and took an exceptionally long time of 2 hours to return to the factory, 1 to 3 p.m., with one of his servants testifying that he did not actually eat anything at all and left almost as soon as he arrived. Frank had both the time and the opportunity to change and clean his suit during his lunch break. In fact, Frank does admit to cleaning up at a critical time. Quote, I took a bath Saturday at my home. I changed my clothes. The clothes that I changed are at home, and this is the suit of clothes I was wearing Saturday. 78. Brief, 245. Unsigned statement made by Frank in the presence of his attorney, Luther Rosser, before Chief of Detectives, Lanford, April 28, 1913. Frank's change of clothes during this critical weekend cloaked him in yet another layer of suspicion. 79. Quote, third man brought into Fagan mystery by Frank's evidence. AC, May 6, 1913. At the trial, factory manager N.V. Darley, D-A-R-L-E-Y, testified that, quote, Mr. Frank had on a brown suit on Saturday and Monday. On Sunday, he had a different suit on. Brief, 32-35. Also, see only ATDSR 31. Brief, 107, black suit, quote-unquote, on Sunday. 210-11, 298. The orchestrated triad of events, the time slip change, the calculated suggestion of where damning, quote, evidence against, quote, the Negro might be found, and the finding of that, quote, evidence, only confirmed police suspicion that the forces now associated with Leo Frank's defense were actively attempting to implicate Newt Lee. The Atlanta Constitution was reticent about outing Frank's conspirators. Instead, the paper meekly asked, quote, is the watchman suspect a victim of planted evidence? You know, they slip in a passive voice. Rather than our Jews trying to frame Newt Lee, they say, is the watchman a victim of planted evidence? Is the real murderer striving to convict an innocent man? It is plausible. Footnote 80. AC, April 30th, 1913, 1, 2. Lee said that the very shirt he was then wearing in jail was the same one he had on when he found the body early Sunday morning, and he had worn that same shirt every day for a week before, explaining that he changed shirts every Sunday. Also, police could not fathom why Lee would not have burned or otherwise disposed of the shirt, especially if he knew enough to place it at the bottom of the clothes hamper. Quote, looks like Frank is trying to put crime on me. AG, April 30th, 1913, afternoon extra edition, 1. Also, quote, the case of Mary Fagan, AC, May 4th, 1913, B5, colon. Why did the detectives wait 2 days after Newt Lee was arrested before they searched his home for evidence? And who was watching his home in the meantime to see that evidence was not planted? 3 days after the murder, the register of the watchman's time clock showed three discrepancies of an hour each. Possibly the clock was registered correctly Sunday. Who was watching to see that it was not changed? End quote. Also, quote, imposters busy in sleuth roles in Fagan case, AC May 4th, 1913, 1, 2, quote, what interest are promoting the planting of evidence in the Mary Fagan mystery? A Pinkerton official said, I'm satisfied that evidence is being planted. The clock record is plainly a, quote, framed up clue. The shirt appears to be, and there are numerous other implications or indications. Also, we are convinced that there are mysterious forces antagonizing our investigation, close quote. Chief of Detectives Newport Lanford declared to reporters that somebody was, quote, blocking Fagan investigation, silencing witnesses, and planting evidence, close quote, 81 footnote, AC May 8, 1913, 1. The bloody shirt episode became the single incident that solidified police suspicion of the B'nai B'rith leader, leading them on Tuesday, April 29th, 3 days after the murder of Mary Fagan, to place him under arrest. Only the bungling ineptitude of the Leo Frank forces saved Newt Lee from being lynched for the murder of Mary Fagan. Lee would remain in jail, but alive and under the protection of police, who now saw him more as a valued witness than as a murder suspect. The physical evidence may have been circumstantial and inconclusive, but the actions of Leo Frank and his representatives had dissipated any lingering doubt. Atlanta police turned their full attention to building the case against Leo M. Frank. As we turn on to 44. Next subsection, the Atlanta press presses for answers. Within 3 days of the murder of Mary Fagan, both Newt Lee and Leo Frank sat in separate jail cells at Atlanta police headquarters. From the discovery of the body early Sunday morning, Atlanta's three daily newspapers, the Constitution, the Journal, and the Georgian, aggressively pursued every facet of the case with unbridled fervor. They profiled the victim and the suspects, examined physical evidence, recreated the murder scene, compared timelines, and dogged police private eyes, witnesses, and suspects for interviews and leads. Newspapers at that time, again before the electronic age really, held immense power over the daily discourse, being the nation's single pre-radio and television source of political, economic, cultural, and social news and issues. The popular Frank narrative stresses that in their competition for readers and advertisers, they put in italics, the Atlanta press stirred up, quote, anti-Semitic passions. But there is little to support that serious charge. Despite the explosive racial dynamics of a fast-unfolding murder case, including Leo Frank's insistence that a, quote, a Negro was responsible, footnote 82, a careful reading of the news coverage in the early stages finds no trace of anti-Semitism at all. 82. Mary Fagan's murder was work of a Negro, declares Leo M. Frank, from the Atlanta Constitution, May 31, 1913. The Anti-Defamation League's recently produced Teacher's Guide on the Fagan murder case claims that, quote, the notion of a perverted Jewish man lusting after innocent Christian children was planted in the minds of jurors and carried to the public through sensational newspaper editorials. Footnote 83. The People versus Leo Frank's Teacher's Guide, New York Anti-Defamation League, 2009, page 16. But not a single article or editorial suggested anything of the sort. Jews are liars. A month after the murder finds the Georgian editorializing an aggressive exoneration of Leo Frank. Long block quote. Frank was never seen with a girl, either on the day of the strangling or before. It is not known that he ever spoke to her, except in connection with her work. Nothing was found to point the finger of accusation directly at Frank, so far as the public has been informed. None of Frank's clothing has been found with bloodstains upon it. No fingerprints upon the girl's body or her clothes were identified as his. None of his personal belongings were found near the girl's body. Absolutely nothing was discovered in the search of the detectives that fastened the crime on him. The police possibly would never even have known that Frank was the last person to see Mary Fagan, so far as is known, had it not been for his own free admission. He told the officers the moment he identified the body that that was the girl he paid at noon the day before. No one else knew that Mary Fagan was in the building at the time, so far as the evidence reveals. Frank did not have to tell if he had desired to conceal the fact. Footnote 84. State faces big task in trial of Frank as Slayer. From the Atlanta Georgian, May 27, 1913, 5. And that narrative accurately represents the tone and tenor of the news coverage by all of Georgia's press. They're leaning over backwards to make the case for this little kike. From the April murder right on through the August trial, so there really was a speedy trial back then. Frank's Jewishness was never mentioned, footnote 85. Though Jews were not targeted, Greeks were. See, quote, Greeks make protest, object to flaring headlines over Fagan mystery. Atlanta Constitution, May 8, 1913, 5, 2, 1, quote, detectives announce they are searching for a Greek, quote, seek missing Greek in Fagan case. Detectives figure strangling was a typical Mediterranean crime, unquote. Atlanta Georgian, May 7, 1913, Night Extra Edition, 1, 2, and, quote, Atlanta Greeks protest against headline published in Extra of an Atlanta afternoon paper. Atlanta Journal, May 8, 1913, 9. Atlanta Constitution, May 9, 1913, 2. Quote, the theory that Mary Fagan was slain by a Greek who worked in a nearby cafe has been disproven and is abandoned by the detectives. Close quote. Frank's Jewishness was never mentioned except by inference when Frank's defenders raised his B'nai B'rith association, and then only as a means of reinforcing his integrity and character in the public's mind. There was no feeling against Jews until this murder. Footnote 86, that was. Atlanta Georgian, May 2, 1913, 1-2. Confidence expressed in Leo M. Frank. Atlanta Journal, May 2, 1913, 5. One example, quote, Leo Frank's friends denounced detention. Atlanta Georgian, April 30th, 1913, 3, quote, Mr. Frank is popular in Jewish social circles and an interested worker in several Jewish charitable organizations, being president of the local order of B'nai B'rith. Close quote. By far, the greatest victim of negative and racist pretrial publicity was Newt Lee, whose Negro-ness was reestablished every time his name was mentioned in print. So intense was this assault that Mayor James Woodward had to step in to warn that a, quote, misleading and sensational headline might inflame an element against Lee, not against Leo Frank. Footnote 87. Mayor confers with chief, says extras are misleading. Atlanta Constitution, April 30th, 1913, 3. Newt Lee was constantly referred to as a, quote, Negro, unquote, and openly threatened with death, even in newspaper headlines. One Constitution article stoked Atlanta's lynching fever with an inflammatory headline, quote, your loyalty or your neck. In that same article, printed 3 days after the murder, Lee's race is referred to 9 times. By contrast, when Frank was arrested, it was not called an arrest, and it did not even make the headline. The news is buried in the 14th paragraph and is delivered protectively, with pains to assure that his, quote, detainment was more in the nature of investigation. The Constitution counsels that it is a routine procedure, not indicative of suspicion. Indeed, the article credits Frank with providing information that led to the arrests of both Lee and one of the first white suspects, James Gant, both Gentiles, footnote 88. Pinkerton's hired to assist police probe the murder of Mary Fagan. Atlanta Constitution, April 29, 1913, quote, it was largely upon Frank's testimony that the search for Gant continued. Atlanta Georgian, April 29, 1913, home edition, extra number 5, 1, quote, the police say that Frank is italics, not under arrest, that he was put under police guard for his own personal safety, and that there are no charges against him. Why then did police act? There must be some reason other than the man's personal safety under consideration. Frank has not yet figured as of importance in the case. Close quote. Later in the article, under the subhead, Frank to be kept under guard, the newspaper gingerly stated, quote, it was learned late this afternoon that Frank will be held on the technical charge of suspicion. He will not be placed in a cell, but will be held under guard. An extra policeman will be employed to keep watch over the factory superintendent in the police station, and Frank will pay for the services of this man. So definitely a better class of prisoner, eh? Better class of treatment in the media for the Jews and the blacks. The next day's headline, Leo M. Frank holds conference with Lee, presents Frank not as a suspect, but as an investigator, or better yet, as an inquisitor. Quote, it was believed Frank would be able to wring a confession from the Negro. 89, that's Atlanta Constitution, April 30th, 1913, 1. Chief of Detectives Newport A. Lanford made it known that even though, quote, Mr. Frank was arrested and placed in custody, he would not be confined to a jail cell. Lanford had actually allowed Frank to employ a, quote, supernumerary policeman, unquote, so that Frank, quote, would be allowed the freedom of headquarters under charge of that policeman. Close quote. Footnote 90, L.M. Frank, factory superintendent, detained by police, Atlanta Journal, April 29, 1913, 1. Frank's religion is never mentioned or alluded to, and he is treated in print with the greatest of respect for his prominence in the community. Despite the well-worn but unprovable claims that the press fanned the flames of anti-Semitism, an analysis published in Forum magazine in 1916 reminds us, quote, and, inasmuch as a race question has become identified with that case, let me remark in passing that all the early, quote, news copy, unquote, relating to it passed through the hands of Jews. The managing editors of two newspapers and the city editor of a third were all Jews. Close quote. Footnote 91. Quote, why was Frank lynched? Was it race hatred, dirty politics, yellow journalism? Question. Forum, December 1916. Supernumerary policeman or not, a little girl was dead and no one lost sight of the fact that Frank was the last man known to have seen Mary Fagan alive. The physical evidence of her murder, the blood and the hair, was found on the same floor where his office was located and where he, by his own admission, had met with the girl just a few minutes before she was murdered. Prosecutors believed they had enough to hang Leo Frank for murder. Next section is the trial of Leo Frank, the theory and the evidence. We'll just get into this for a page and then we'll be done. In calling the state of Georgia's case against Leo Frank, quote, persuasive, the writer of a 742-page book in the case, Steve Oney, confronts those who suggest that anti-Semitic prejudicial rage motivated his prosecution. Footnote 92. Oney, ATDSR, 335. By the time of the trial, Mary Fagan's murder had been investigated by the coroner's office and four professional agencies, the Atlanta Police Department, the Georgia State Prosecutor's Office, and the Pinkerton and William J. Burns detective agencies. The latter two were in the employ of Leo Frank, yet all four settled on a surprisingly similar theory, footnote 93, which revolved around a spider and web scenario. 93, Atlanta Journal, May 19, 1913, 1. A headline and story, Atlanta Journal, July 18, 1913, 1, claiming that the Pinkertons had changed their view of Frank's guilt, were mistaken. They contended that on Saturday, April 26, Frank used the occasion of the weekly payday falling on a holiday when the factory was closed and deserted to corner the unsuspecting 13-year-old Mary Fagan into a sexual encounter. When she resisted him, the 29-year-old Frank used brute force to subdue her, and in the ensuing struggle, he accidentally knocked her unconscious. Realizing the dire consequences of his act, Frank then intentionally killed her by strangling her with a 6-foot piece of heavy twine of the kind commonly used around the factory. The circumstantial chain of time, motive, and opportunity, along with the physical evidence, made Frank's conviction likely, though not trouble-free. The jury would not only have to weigh the prosecution's scenario, but also have to consider whether any other theory was even plausible. As lead prosecutor Hugh Dorsey would say, it was not a, quote, chain, unquote, of evidence, for the chain is not stronger than its weakest link. Instead, the state's case was more like the strands of a rope, direct quote, where none of them may be sufficient in itself, but all taken together may be strong enough to establish the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. Footnote 94, argument of Hugh Dorsey, 71. Also, quote, evidence against Frank conclusive, say police. Atlanta, Georgia, May 26, 1913, home edition 1. And that will conclude our session for today. So we see that despite what the Jews would claim in later years, all the evidence led to their man. He was treated with kid gloves, and the media went all out to blame an innocent black guy and to ignore what was very clear. The Jews were trying to frame this black guy, Newt Lee, first, for the guilty actions of one of their own. It really shows what Jews are, and it shows how corrupt the media is even back then. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do more from the Nation of Islam book on Leo Frank.